wanted to be kept abreast of what language was adopted by the Senate. And I would prefer probably the, I think that he would prefer the second language suggested by Mr. Kramer of the likelihood of harm rather than likelihood of success.
Yes.
Right.
I don't know whether the record picked you up on that. Did you want it on the record?
No.
Comments or questions?
Comment.
Yes, Senator Warner.
I like the language that counsel said he was interested, he was trying to get at rather than the likelihood language. I think that language in the draft would cause problems with that.
What about the, how do we address the possibility that one spouse, it would usually be the male, I suppose, would be coercing the female into a joint custody agreement? Is there a danger of that, and how do we... And this bill, I don't think, addresses that possibility. Is that too far-fetched?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the state court administrator will speak to that issue on behalf of Judge Joseph from the Court of Appeals, and he has some recommendations on that issue.
Okay. Then the only other question is, not a question, but here we've got six pages of forms that we're sticking in the code. Some members of this committee...
Somebody needs to justify to us why.
Yeah, some members of this committee are not too receptive to the idea of continuing to expand on the Oregon Revised Statutes with these forms.
If I may.
Is there a way that we could... The last one of these bills that we dealt with, we just put in the criteria and we took the form out. Now, is there a way to work that out here?
I'm not certain, Mr. Chair. I will say that those forms were put in by Representative Bellamy. He believed, and this bill is in part a compilation of a number of bills on domestic relations that were submitted by various groups, including the Fathers Pack, and he felt that this was a way to make people have access to the courts more easily, and I don't know of any way to approach it, actually.
Mr. Chairman, introduce a form for the State Fair for livestock judging at the 4-H. So that's something Representative Bellamy does. Maybe if we had a form that we just get one of the people that's at the fair to check off on confirmation of the hindquarters and things like that, it would work just as well.
Well, I think council might come back with an idea as to whether this really is could be handled in a different way. Senator Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first session in the House, when the first time we faced the joint custody issue, I recall receiving a hearing testimony from witnesses that really the only way the joint custody works is if the people really agree up front. And this mediation thing troubles me a little bit because that is what I recall. Now, is that, from a standpoint of practice, is that... correct or incorrect?
I think that that's correct, and that's the conclusion that the House Judiciary Committee came to. As to mediation, they felt that in instances where somebody may not really understand what joint custody is, that it may be valuable for someone to go into that process or not understand why they don't want to do it or have kinds of concerns which could be easily alleviated by someone saying, this is what it really means, you still have these kinds of controls, you can divide it in these sorts of ways, that it would be useful to have people in that setting and that it might alleviate tensions between the parties and be in the best interest of the child as a result.
Chairman.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
So what you contemplate in mediation is basically kind of an outlining of alternatives or what could be done? Because every time I think of this dividing things down the middle, man, I know maybe we're talking that's really arbitration, but it seems, at least as I recall, is that if both parties really don't agree that it's not in the best interest of anybody involved.
I think that that's right, and hopefully after mediation, the parties will be able to come to a more informed view of whether they want to do it or not.
Well,
I think that's the goal.
What happens?
Then there's no joint custody, and they return to the courtroom, basically.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Senator Cohen.
I'm sorry, this is turning this into a work session. And I guess I don't want to do that, but I guess I'll get some information to Senator Hill with studies that worked in California, how they run mediation in Clackamas County, and how they run it in California, and how the joint custody.
Open to that, Senator Cohen.
All right, thank you both.
Thank you.
Gene Meskey.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Meschke. I work for Judge Joseph on the Oregon Court of Appeals, and no, I am not the state court administrator, but I am here to talk about the memo that he sent to the committee last Friday recommending two proposed amendments to House Bill 2718. I guess if you've seen the memo, I could just answer questions. Otherwise, I could go ahead and just explain what it was he intended by his suggestion.
What is it?
Let's go.
Wants to know whether
go ahead and explain it. Okay.
Oh, whether we've read the proposed amendments? Oh, yeah, we've read them, but you can go ahead and comment on them. Okay. You don't have to read them, but I'd like to have your comments.
Well, on Section 6, in Sub 1, on page 2, the House Committee had put in the phrase parents' equal rights and responsibilities. That's how the bill originally read on line 6. And the phrase equal rights was used in two different places. They amended the word equal to shared rights, and they just failed to amend that in the second place in that subsection 1. That's just a technical change that Judge Joseph recommends, that you catch the amendment later in Sub 1. The other proposal he has is more substantive, and it relates to some of the questions Senator Hamby had, at least, that on the sub 4 of Section 6 should not completely take away the discretion for the court to overrule a joint agreement to joint custody. And I think you guys noticed the language in subsection 5, which says that if the parties fail to cooperate in a joint custody, that does constitute a change of circumstances sufficient to modify a joint order. But the question that we had reading this was, how can you modify it to sole custody if subsection 4 says sole custody in no way can be allowed? He recommended two ways to change that, simply by deleting subsection 4 and changing the shall in subsection 3 to a may, or by leaving in subsection 4 and just granting the judge the discretion in the best interest of the child to go ahead and overrule a joint agreement. That's all I have.
All right.
If there's questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yes, Senator Cohen.
Yes. I thought he wanted to get out of the domestic relations business. You can ask him that question.
Any other messages to go back to the chief judge? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We want the elimination of de novo review.
I think, sure.
It says in the relating clauses relating to domestic relations.
You bet.
Amazing you didn't say that here.
Okay. Okay, Gene Atkins, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Gene Atkins, lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. Just very briefly, you have a statement before you in support of this bill by the Women's Rights Coalition. Our special concern that we bring to this issue is a concern for the well-being of families headed by single women, who are often the sole custodians of children. and face a great many social and economic pressures as part of that lifestyle. We want to make sure that although we are pleased that the state will be encouraging the value of two-parent contact after divorce, that there are neither economic or legal pressures put on sole custodians to enter into or not to be participants in joint custody arrangements. We support House Bill 2718 specifically because it doesn't either impose joint custody arrangements on unwilling parents or overrule agreements between parents to attempt joint custody agreements. So the very issues that you're talking about today are the issues that we bring concerns to in this area. We also endorse as a crucial part of this bill Section 6 sub 2 establishing that a joint custody award will not by itself mean that either parent has a diminished support obligation so that the economics of the situation are not altered by granting joint custody as opposed to sole custody. Happy to answer any questions, just in general our endorsement of the bill.
Questions?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Warren.
How do you feel about Judge Joseph's suggestion that the court, if the court he or she sees in being involved in the dissolution, that it's not in the best interest of the child to have a joint custody, which might include the court feeling that, that although there's no outright duress, that there's been some heavy salesmanship by one or the other that really doesn't track with the best interest of the child. He wants us to change subsection 4 to say that the court could then decide not to put into effect the agreement of the parents.
Well, giving discretion in that situation, there is a trade-off there. There is always the potentiality for as you say, duress or some sort of, as you say, heavy salesmanship to come into a situation and someone feel obligated to enter into a joint custody arrangement so as not to have to err even in a mediation circumstance. The kinds of difficulties that they would have in a relationship with the other parent, and that is certainly of concern. However, giving the discretion to the court does not necessarily guarantee that that's the circumstance in which that discretion will be exercised either. There is a place at which I think we have to perhaps, if we are going to foster and encourage joint custody arrangements when they can be worked out, we do have to have some trust in the parents who are coming forward that there is a mutually agreed upon agreement here. Certainly there may be other ways in questioning and in dealing with the parties involved that some exploration of those issues can happen. I'm not a practitioner, so I may not be able to technically give suggestions as to how that would happen, but that is sort of a choice that we had to make in terms of looking at both encouraging involvement of both parents and wanting the law to encourage it, not wanting courts who might be reluctant simply because they don't like that concept to be able to impose their will on those parents for that reason, with, of course, the as you say, the risk that in some circumstances, unknown to everyone involved, that there is a coercive agreement that's been reached to do joint custody. I think there's kind of a toss-up there.
Let's say it's not coercive. Let's just say that it's pretty clear to a judge who's sitting up there probably frequently 20 years older than either parent, and that they think that what's being done isn't going to be help the child. Parents have entered into something that's more convenient, more their convenience is being looked into more than the child's well-being. You don't think that the judge ought to be able to sit up there and if they observe something they think going wrong, be able to refuse. You want to just take the discretion away from the judge to enter into the process. Mm-hmm. You've already answered the question. I'm sorry, I saw there were some changes happening here. I'm just surprised the change is so complete. You've gone, as a group, you've gone from being really quite opposed to two sessions ago altogether to joint custody, now being willing to take away the discretion for a judge to be able to overrule it based on a finding that they see some reason why it's not good. You may be right. I was on the other side.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. B. Smith.
My name is Victor Smith, and I'm the president of DADS, and we have some interest in domestic relations legislation. I would like to suggest that, of course, there are many fathers out there who would like to continue to participate in the rearing of their children post-divorce. It's been my experience after a number of years and many hours and many, many telephone calls and more letters than I care to count that the fathers who are divorced still and wish to participate still prefer the notion of the presumption of joint custody. It's my understanding after reading much of the literature and the views that come from these bodies that you're not ready yet to accept the notion of the presumption of joint custody. I would hope that you still might consider that. After reviewing this piece of legislation, it appears that at this time that that's probably as far as we're going to get insofar as wording. I'd like to suggest some slight modifications, if I might, and I will stand ready to answer questions in just a second. One of the modifications that I'd like to suggest is that the notion of a support-paying father, normally referred to as an obligor, be responsible for the school expenses of a child after age 18, where if you're a married father, you do have the right to tell your son or daughter that you can't afford it. You have just taken a $4 an hour wage cut from the local sawmill and that all family members will have to work. As a divorced father, you're not allowed to say that. You cannot say that. You are obligated, duty-bound by the law, to support regardless of what your situation is. Your right to teach the value of money to your children, allowing them to earn their way to higher education, as I'm sure many of you did, that has been thwarted. So I'd like to suggest some amendments in that part of the bill that makes references to that. In addition, I would like to suggest that to have a father pay more money than the state does for, say, foster care in some cases, might also be considered a little unusual. You might let any excesses be at the option of the father. There are many of us out there who would like to pay more and will at our own option. But to be mandated and told and at the same time be disallowed the quality parenting time, the equal parenting time, and equal rights of that child, sometimes it's a little harsh. I'd like to suggest that you consider the legislative research that Margie Hendrickson had done on the notion of joint custody the last legislative session. Statistics looked very, very impressive, more impressive than we could have gone out and purchased. That's about all I have to say for right now, and I stand ready to answer any questions.
Questions? All right. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Bill Linden?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. I sent over a letter earlier today, and I wanted to just touch on two points involved there. First of all, subsection 4 of section 6, I'd strongly urge you to consider leaving with the trial court judges some discretion in the award of joint custody, particularly to deal with those situations where there might be some evidence that one of the parties has bartered away their rights or has been coerced into agreeing to a joint custody arrangement. What I would specifically recommend is that the section be amended so that a judge could order sole custody and require that judge to state on the record why they are doing so, make findings both on the record and in the decree. We have talked with a number of our circuit court judges who handle domestic relations cases, and is their clear preference that there be some discretion carved out for them to deal with the best interest of the child, and they think that if they had the authority to order sole custody in appropriate circumstances but had to make particular findings as to why they're doing it, that there would be adequate protections built in. The second issue I wanted to touch on relates to Section 12 and something the Chair referred to earlier, and that has to do with the forms that are included in the bill. It's my strong preference that we don't put forms in statute, and it's further my strong preference that the courts not be required to provide these forms, and particularly to provide them to one class of litigants for free. If we're allowed to charge for these forms, there's still a negative fiscal impact for the courts, and that is that we bear the cost of developing and printing the forms, but any revenues go directly into the general fund as opposed to going back into the court budget. It's not that this isn't an important type of proceeding, but I question whether or not it warrants special treatment for the litigants involved, that special treatment being the provision of forms by the court to these individuals. What also happens when we provide forms is we invariably end up explaining them and helping the parties fill them out, which takes valuable clerk time. I don't mean to minimize the importance of these types of proceedings, but I'm not sure they deserve that special status.
Questions? Senator Hamby.
May I ask, Bill, did you testify, as you just did, before the House Committee, Judiciary Committee regarding the forms?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hamby, I sent a letter to the House Committee. I did not testify personally.
It's my understanding the idea stems from Representative Bellamy's belief that this would allow consistency and...
Mr. Chair, Senator Hamby, there are other ways, I think, to get that consistency. There are business supply establishments that provide standard forms that are used extensively in the trial courts, and typically what an outfit like Stevens Ness will be to, as laws change and certain things are required in legal papers and pleadings, they'll develop forms that can be used uniformly and purchased and used.
Anything else?
There's always Peggy Muse, too.
Pardon me, Senator.
Okay, thank you.
Peggy Muse.
All right, we'll close the hearing on 2718. We'll go to work session of Senate Bill 566. We'll follow the work session of 566 with the work session on Senate Bill 1039.
Chairman, 566 is the garnishment bill.
1039.
Where are these amendments?
I don't think she ought to be put out of business.
Whose amendments are these?
The dash two amendments that you have before you that are being handed out are the amendments from the Judicial Department. They were presented after consultation with several representative of banks, and they make clarifications in language with one or two possible exceptions that Brad Swank could explain. I don't believe there's anything substantive in any substantive changes between the dash one and dash two amendments.
Now, are the are these amendments the ones that Mr. Marcus wanted to comment on?
The dash three?
The one?
Yes.
All right.
Well,
I think the dash two are mainly technical, are they not?
Okay, Mr. Marcus, did you want to comment upon either dash two or dash three? Yes or no?
Yes.
All right, come up. Then Brad Swank probably will like to call on you for a brief comment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Marcus. I'm with Legal Aid. Very briefly, I should disclose that I'm theoretically opposed to the concept of taking the enforcement of judgments out of the neutral courthouse and putting them in the hands of an advocate for one of the sides, just as a disclosure. I think that's incorrect. The most sensitive area where that has its impact is the adjudication of claims of exemption from execution where a debtor says, as a matter of law, you can't take this away from me because the legislature has made a decision that this is exempt from execution. Most typically that's paycheck, portion of the paycheck. It may be any of the number of exempt assets that you have. The major change that the amendments make, as compared to existing law, is that to file a claim of exemption in time to freeze the assets until the court decides whether they're really exempt under this bill and these amendments, the debtor would have to serve up to four people, with copies of the claim of exemption. Under present law, the debtor just gives the paper to the same person who served the writ of execution or writ of garnishment or what have you, the sheriff or the civil process deputy, and that person is responsible for distributing notice to the creditor and any other interested parties. Under this bill, in order to freeze those assets pending the adjudication, it's critical for the debtor to read through the papers. And I should say that there's been a great deal of attention to making these forms informative to people whose level of functional literacy is high. You can figure out who to serve by reading the papers carefully. There's a lot of information under these forms, which would now be in the statutes, which is very helpful to a literate and functionally literate debtor. The problem is so many people who are unrepresented, who are having bill problems, who are judgment debtors, will find perfection of their rights effectively precluded from them by the added complexity of service of their claim of exemption. That's my major concern.
Can you, you're saying then that by changing the law, by putting, how is it that by that this bill makes it harder for debtors?
They have to serve the claim of exemption on more people. Under present law, they give the claim of exemption back to the court or the sheriff.
Oh.
Under this
and
form...
And that's up to the sheriff, correct?
It's typically the sheriff. Right. And the sheriff is then responsible for getting everything together. The creditor is then motivated, because the money is in the court's hands and hasn't reached the creditor, is then motivated to make sure that there's a hearing on the claim of exemption so it can be decided by the court whether the assets are truly exempt from execution or not. Under this bill, the money can go straight to the attorney, but then in order for the debtor to get the claim of exemption heard and the assets frozen, the debtor has to serve as many as four people. Now, the addresses are on the forms for the most part, so if the debtor really knows what he or she is doing and understands and is functionally literate enough so that they can go through here, figure out what they have to do. They have a very short period of time in which to do it. They have 10 days to serve the first person, then they have 2 days to serve the next person. As from my experience dealing with poor debtors, and I should say legal aid's been out of the garnishment business, the garnishment defense business, for quite some time just by our priorities, but years ago when we did lots of those, so many of our clients just cannot figure out what to do, even with the present system, that if you add three more places they have to serve and deadlines and whatnot, it's going to be hopeless for the unrepresented debtor with limited functional literacy.
Well, he's really brought up 2 points now, and I want to ask one about the other one, but does anybody want to ask a question about that particular point?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, counsel.
I guess what I'm curious about is whether the more difficult task is completing the claiming of exemption or delivering it. I guess it would seem to me that once it's completed, that the hard part is over and that delivery is relatively simple.
Well, if you look at the form, basically all you have to do is, it says I'm claiming an exemption and here's the reason. Under existing law, you file it, you get it to somebody. I think getting it to somebody on time and figuring out who that is clearly the more challenging of the two requirements now, because getting it to somebody and putting your name on it, everything that's needed to be known is already of record. That is to say, who the plaintiff is, who the parties are, the court number, all of that is already there. I think the assets are exempt because is not a very challenging thing to fill out functionally. To say the right thing may be challenging, but it doesn't matter if you say the right thing. The hard part is figuring out what to do with the piece of paper, and it's much, much harder if you got to serve four people within one person within 10 days and then three people within 2 days thereafter. This is something which, as a practical matter, many of my clients will never be able to do. It's just not something they do in their normal. They don't transact their affairs in business in writing. They don't put things in envelopes and mail them. They don't serve process. They don't serve papers on opponents. They're not lawyers. They're not represented typically.
And they don't have staffers to do all that for them either.
Well, what about the lawyers? Did you say that they're going to get money in their hands quicker than they have before, because it's not going to go through the court, is it?
That's right. It goes straight to the lawyer or to the creditor. There is a requirement punishable by contempt, as I understand it, under these amendments, that you, if there's a timely filed, if there's a perfected claim of exemption, you have to send the money into court if you're the creditor's attorney. But what if you already know that the debtor only served the sheriff and didn't serve, or just served you and didn't serve anybody else? Do you still have to send the money, since the claim of exemption hasn't been perfected?
What I'm leading up to, or what you've triggered off in my mind, is: are we going to now? Is this something that we ought to get the Lester Rawls people to comment on? Because are we going to have lawyers who are going to have money that'll later be determined they should have not held on to all of or turned all of over to their client because there were valid claims of exemption? I would think the courts would probably liberally, in some cases, construe the laws to protect the debtor. It might turn out that the lawyer then would be found to have handled the money improperly. We might have more claims against the fund that they have in the state bar for monies that have been used improperly.
I suppose that's at least theoretically possible, but the economic level at which my concern is focused, that's not the problem.
Those amendments to correct those errors are with you now, and they're...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those are the dash six amendments.
And what I have described is how the Act was supposed to have come out of committee, basically. And another thing that the bill does is it makes it clear that under the, if you get an Abuse Prevention Act order, you still have a right to visitation. And when these orders are appealed, about 90% of them are appealed because the other party doesn't feel they have adequate visitation or has no visitation. And we feel making it clear to the court that visitation should be awarded unless there's some, it's not in the best interest of the child, we'll rectify that report and make the Act work better. And Mr. Representative Bellamy has other things to say about it.
Yes, Representative Bellamy, go ahead.
Thank you, Senators. For the record, Bill Bellamy, House District 55. The reason that I introduced the bill is because the Deschutes County people came to me and said there is some real abuses of this act. And we started out way early, maybe 6 months before the session, and I turned them over to Legislative Council and we started drafting the bill. We really spent a lot of time, and I will tell you that I understand now why Deschutes County has some problems. And Deschutes County in their, what's the term I want, Ira?
Mediation.
In their mediation rules does not allow some things, and the only way they can get it is through the Abuse Prevention Act. And their mediation rules are part of the problem. And it took me about until March or April of this session till I finally figured it out. Why is it that just Deschutes County seems to have the greatest number of problems? Part of the problem is their mediation rules. And their mediation rules do not allow for temporary custody. So therefore, if you want temporary custody, you just file for abuse prevention. And that's what every attorney will tell you in Deschutes County. They say, I abuse it, I'll be very open. Well, we really worked on the House side trying not to ruin the Act, because the Act is very good and it works, and we understand that, and we did not want to take the teeth out of the Act for somebody who is truly being abused. And I think the amendments do that. Now, we didn't go so far, I don't believe we went so far as a hearing, or did we?
Well, there is a hearing. You can ask for a hearing. There's not an automatic hearing.
I understand that Senator Wires has some concerns there, and probably the main reason why we didn't go to a mandatory hearing is because of the fiscal impact. And The bill as amended probably...
You're right, I have some concerns, but not that I was insisting on a requirement.
Okay. I just heard that, and I think it's valid, Senator Wires. Without the fiscal impact, I would say that there ought to be a hearing. The fiscal impact for the counties that do and do not have mediation causes you to step back and say, maybe I can take second best instead of what's best. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and Ira is totally right. We just simply did not catch the technical amendments that are before you in the dash six. Was supposed to be there, and when the bill got printed, it wasn't. We said, let's send it to the Senate. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. And I want to publicly thank Ira and his crew, because they really assisted and spent a lot of hours. I will tell Senator Brockman that there are still attorneys in Deschutes County that are not, they do not believe that this goes far enough. They believe that there should be a hearing, and that they believe that there should not be temporary custody given with the abuse prevention. We know that without temporary custody, the Abuse Prevention Act will not be used. It was originally drafted without temporary custody being given. It was found that it was not being used 2 years ago.
It was more than that.
Several years ago, temporary custody was added to the act, and now it's being used. And so my conclusions was to leave in the temporary custody simply because the act does need to be used. If a person is being abused, you need the provisions of this act. But let me tell you, the abuse of this very fine piece of legislation is very strong, and if you heard some of the actual cases, you would be very discouraged with how this original act is being used in a total wrong fashion, but attorneys will admit it has become a tool in the court with the temporary custody battle.
Senator Brockman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question to Mr. Zaroff. In your working with Representative Bellamy, is this problem peculiar only to Deschutes County?
No, it's not. There's problems in Multnomah County also, mostly because the judges there don't have any hearing whatsoever. In most counties, they have some hearing. It's not a recorded hearing, but they have some hearing. In Multnomah County, there's also, I talked to practitioners, and there are some problems there too. Other areas where they have hearings and the judges actually do what they're supposed to do, I say it no other way, is it works much better.
Follow up on that, Representative?
Well, I would simply say that's very true. The real abuse occurs when the judges believe, and they honestly believe, they have no leeway in the present law. If you fill out the form and you meet those criteria, they have to give the abuse prevention. My response is, why don't you ask questions like, where are the children presently? Let me give you an example. There was an individual in Deschutes County, the mother, this is not the father, this is the reverse roles. The mother was over here in the valley, had not been with the kids, filed for a dissolution. They'd been separated, but you see, this gets back to Deschutes County's mediation rules. Filed for a divorce, and in the immediate process filed for abuse, threatened abuse about a year ago. Asked for custody of the children. The judge awarded her custody of the children. She went over to Deschutes County, brought the children over here to the valley. And 6 months later, when they finally got into the divorce proceedings, the judge looked at this and said, you should have never had those children to start with. And my response was, why didn't the judge ask at the original hearing of the abuse prevention, who has the children? Now, that's some of the awful things that have been happening. And this bill, I think, will help. It does say to the judge, we want you to ask questions. We want you to find out, you know, a little more about the situation. But part of the problem is Deschutes County mediation rules, too. And I have written a letter and encouraging them to look at that, saying that this can't be the only way you can get temporary custody.
Senator Cohen.
I want to I think we're starting in the right direction, and I think we've done, this bill goes about as far as we can go. Been through that in this committee. I don't want to give up the bill or the usefulness of it. I do think that there are a lot of education of judges that has to take place. I've had extensive debate with at least two of my circuit court judges who are dear friends of mine who just plain don't like this. They don't like it because it's somehow an insult to them that somebody could make a decision on their own without the judge deciding, you know, that someone could make this sort of alleging on a piece of paper and that they might be right. It is almost a personal kind of thing with certain judges who just don't want to try to cope with something that's not within the traditional way of their doing business, and it's hard. But I think I'm supportive of the bill with your technical amendments. I think we ought to try to continue to press to make them have it work right and to do what investigating the mediation rules and the court rules to make it work right. So that's my.
You're supportive. You're supportive of the Ingross House bill with the dash.
Was it six amendments or the one?
Dash six or dash five for both.
Mr. Chairman, if you may, dash six of the amendments that were passed by the House Judiciary Committee didn't make it to the printed bill. The dash five or some other technical amendments.
Oh, I see.
Either one, actually. Later. I think they're both probably appropriate as far as I know. I just.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Yes, I think the dash five that Eric just spoke to is important. And for Representative Bellamy's dash five clearly allows the I am in immediate and present danger of further abuse to stand out and to alert the individual. And I think they're good.
I think Mr. Linden's here to testify on those. I think, are you? Okay, I'm not asking for you right now. I just wanted to alert Representative Bellamy that if he wanted to stay and listen to you, that. That's what you were here for. Senator Wires, do you have any comment?
I wanted to ask either Mr. Bellamy, Representative Bellamy, or Mr. Zaroff, what happened here with I'm not interested in how the mistake happened. The version that got to the floor wasn't the version that the committee had finally acted on, but what was the discussion versus whether there'd be a written or tape-recorded record or not? And it appears that the dash six amendment deletes that language, doesn't it?
Yes.
And that would appear to be one way to increase the likelihood that a judge, if you say to a judge, okay, I want it on the record, then they say, okay, then they get the court reporter in there, and you get out of the situation where the judge is saying, well, okay, boom, or I'm not going to listen to this or something. It makes it something where there's a record. We're all used to that around here. And I'm sure it's going to, I know Mr. Linden came and talked to me and said it's going to cost money. It's clear it would. Is that the reason it was taken out, because the court administrator wanted it taken out?
Yes.
And Senator Wires, I should point out that in Multnomah County, don't use the term judge. They fill out the form and they give it to the clerk, and when the form's filled out, they go in and the judge stamps it. The judge never talks to the victim. Now,
the same thing in Washington County.
I don't approve of that procedure, but I'm not here to fiscally say that in order to do it right, I want to jeopardize cleaning up. You can see
that
where
what you're
my
talking
problem
about
was.
When you first start talking about a hearing? Okay. Yes. I didn't understand that. Because doing it on the record is a hearing in the technical sense of hearing, but it's not a hearing in the sense of a contest, which is sort of the lay view. You understand that the
talking about a recorded, not
because it's not going to cost
hearing
near what it does to get two lawyers or even two parties up there arguing with each other. The court reporter typically is there. Does it say written or tape recording? So in a rural county where you didn't have a legal stenographer there, a human being court reporter there, you could use a tape recorder. Did they say how much more it would cost? I'm sure it would cost a few dollars each time, multiplied by several hundred a year, so it would cost some money. Well,
Senator Wise, we did not have cost. We frankly were working with so many different amendments that we finally said, let's get something done, and I have to honestly say that we figured that at that point the court administrator on the Senate side would be better able to really assess the fiscal impact. This bill, from the way it started to the way it ended up, there were so many amendments that pretty soon we were all getting confused.
You, unless you know the answer right this minute, Bill, would you tell us before you leave here whether you have any objection to the Dash 5 amendments? And then we'll have Bill Linden come up and explain those.
I'll look at him and do
maybe
that.
Maybe he's not going to explain it. Whose amendments are
those? Those are amendments that I asked LC to draft based on some technical problems that I discovered in the bill.
Oh, I see. They're innocuous then. Just a technical problem.
Let me just review them very briefly. First part of the amendments require that the court also be informed of pending divorce proceedings in addition to pending custody proceedings. The second part of the amendment deals with the situation of unmarried parents, and the court should be informed of pending paternity or filiation proceedings. The third part of the amendment informs the person applying for the relief that they've got to clearly and specifically delineate that there's got to be a clear and present danger of future abuse. In the printed bill, it looked like it was just one of those optional boxes that you could check off. So we've set that off as a separate subsection, Roman numeral 5.
Well, maybe you could get back to counsel sometime, and if you've got any objections or suggestions on that one, okay?
On appearance, I have no objection to the Dash 5.
All right. Any other questions by committee members? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Bill Linden, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. I want to urge you to adopt the Dash 6 amendments. You've alluded to our concerns that we had on and expressed on the House side. In practice, we are not holding reported hearings in each and every abuse prevention case. Typically, in the counties that were mentioned, there may be a hearing held if there was a person who came in and filed a petition that was actually visibly injured. In Washington County, I understand that they will hold a hearing if the respondent contests the petition, but in reality, those hearings are not occurring in the many petitions that are filed. And if we're going to require that there be actual hearings on the record reported either electronically or stenographically, it is going to have a fiscal impact on the operations of the court. The presiding juvenile judge and domestic relations judge in Multnomah County estimated that he would need a halftime pro tem judge to conduct those on-the-record hearings. And using that estimate and information from other counties, we estimated a total fiscal impact of approximately $340,000 for a biennium. Most of that pro tem judge time involved in the additional hearing process that we would be embarking on. I think it's fair to say that the judges have gotten a message from the discussions regarding this bill on the House side about their role in the system, and I think it is also fair that some judges did not like the Abuse Prevention Act concept. Some may still not like it today, but the message that has gone out to them is that in dealing with these petitions, they need to give them the attention they deserve. If a hearing is warranted, they need to hold a hearing. Hearings that are held right now, and there are very few of them, typically are reported. But I would strongly suggest that we not mandate a hearing on the record in each and every case, because it's just going to have a tremendous impact on the workload of the bench.
Okay. Questions, Mr. Linden? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that'll close the hearing on House Bill 2898. All right. Now, I'm ready to proceed on Senate Bills 313, 314, and 315. Jack Frost, would it be a pain for you? I'm looking now. We have the same three proponents and the same three opponents on each of these three bills. It will probably take, my guess is it will probably take about 15 minutes to present an overview by the proponents on these three bills, which I assume the committee members are willing to stay in here. And maybe, I don't know how much time it will actually take, or or how long the opponents would like to have, but I mention that because it may be that we wouldn't complete a hearing today. We'd have to carry it over till maybe Thursday, and I don't want to inconvenience anybody, but I know that apparently three of you came from the same spot up in Washington County. Well, I'm just going to, we'll just start on it, and I'll keep an eye on my committee members, and as long as we can provide you with some audience, well, we'll go on with this bill. So let's have,
I don't think I'm going to be here very long.
Okay. We'll see if we can't get through with the proponents. Constance Hawes and is it Clark Greer?
That might make some ridiculous.
And, you know, there's a reason why these witness registration slips say print names. It looks like somebody green. I could be wrong.
Right.
In any event, how about the three proponents of Senate Bill 313 coming up here? I've been covering up the mic as I've been talking.
Rather than taking the time to introduce the constituents, they are my constituents, and yes, they represent more than, in fact, a statewide group of lay citizens that have brought to the Interim Judiciary Committee's attention concerns that they carry regarding our medical examiner's laws.
Very good. And I know that the Interim Committee and Senator Hamby worked a lot on this, and I'm sorry that you're not having a committee of seven to talk at here, but a couple members, you know, have other committees they have to go to. So we'll start anyway, and either Senator Hamby or whoever Senator Hamby wants to designate can kind of give us an overview on how to start this thing. In fact, Senator Hamby, you can call on whoever you want
right
here.
Connie will walk us through it.
All right, that'd be fine.
Mr. Chair.
Counsel.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, attached to a part of your Senate measure analysis is a hand-engrossed version of all three bills. Those reflect the substantial deletions that are proposed by the sponsors of the bill. So I think, in essence, the hand-engrossed versions is what we'll be discussing.
Okay. Everybody get a copy of that, Counselor?
Yeah.
Let's go ahead, and as each one of you speaks, if you'll, first time you speak, if you'll identify yourself by name and where you live for the record.
For the record, Constance Hawes, 19920 Southwest Oak Court in Aloha. I am representing Concerned Citizens for Laws of Consent, a two-year-old citizens organization that organized around the issue of problems that were revealed in the medical examiners program in Oregon 2 years ago. We've worked for 2 years with Senator Hamby and with legislative counsel on the production of the bills before you, and the deletions are the result of a consensus to try to focus in on what the most important issues are now. I want to thank the committee chairperson and the committee themselves for taking the time, sparing the time, to at least consider the issue in this session.
By the way, did my staff provide you people with this hand-engrossed consolidation of all three bills or not?
Not the hand-engrossed. We provided them a copy with our deletions marking.
Okay.
I believe Mark did the hand-engrossed from that.
So we're all talking about the same thing, essentially.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Go ahead.
Very briefly, I'd like to refer to my written testimony and then to the summary that you've been provided in your notebooks. The notebook that we brought around individually to each of the committee members last week, the blue notebook, was simply to reference to you a glimpse and a reminder of the events and the climate that produced the concern and the organization of our group. And, of course, wasn't meant to be read, as it was a very thick notebook. Our membership draws mostly from families that have experienced a result of the problems that were revealed 2 years ago regarding unauthorized donation of body parts. Others, like myself, have not had personal experience with this type of problem, but are concerned because of the inconsistencies between that practice and a present Oregon law, which in fact predates the medical examiner's law called the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which is a property right law. Others in our group are deputy medical examiners, funeral home directors, and members of American Native groups, and others interested in the outcome of this concern in Oregon, or especially the Commission on Uniform State Laws, represented by Mr. John McCabe, who has asked for a final report on the outcome of this, as they have never had a problem with any state and something being in conflict with the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act since it was passed in 1969, and they're very concerned about the outcome of this issue. Others who will receive a final report on the outcome of this issue are two professional boards that deal with pathologists. In one is international in scope and one is national in scope, and they've asked for a final report as well. The needs addressed in the bills before you are described in your copy of the summary prepared for Senator Kitzhaber. We feel this legislation addresses three types of problems. The types of problems are related in that mostly they concern being informed and informed consent, and that's the major issue for our group. The three types of problems referred to in your summary are procedural problems, communication or documentation problems, and oversight. These bills began as a response to points made in Mr. Mark Perrin's letter to the Attorney General's office. He was the special prosecutor that the Attorney General selected when they were having their investigation 2 years ago. Several points were expanded upon that you find in those bills and grew out of the research that our group undertook while we were looking at what might be done or what might be proposed to ameliorate the problems that had been revealed by the Attorney General's report. Research on legislative history of both the enactment of ORS 146 in 1973 and the enactment of ORS 97.250 through 290 in 1969 led us to other points that we felt needed to be included in these bills. I refer you also to that letter from Mr. Perrin in the notebook that was provided to you, in which he highlights that the present 146.117, the autopsy statute presently, is ambiguous, and our major concern is in fact that the other issues that came to light as a result of our research on that issue are secondary for us, but nonetheless important. As Mildred Schwab said at a hearing recently on another matter, once identified as ambiguous, she has never seen a statute left that way on purpose, and I hope that this committee will be able to take the time to look into the ambiguity of that law and make a decision regarding that. Each of the proposals remaining in these bills responds to a need that we see as not being met in the present statutes, a need for specific regulation or documentation or oversight. You have before you also in the packet provided from us more than 20 letters from other individuals who are members or associated with CCLC, Concerned Citizens for Laws of Consent, who would have been here to testify today if we had time for a lengthy hearing. I ask you to please take specific note of those communications. Many of them are from families who have experienced the personal problems with the structure as it was in the past. I would like to stress that There is a Section 21 in SB 313, and if you'd like to deal with the summary first, step by step, we can do that rather than continuing on with my specific points about that section, which I have some explanation about a survey I did in California, since it is based on a California law. We feel that nothing in these bills imperils the functioning of the state's medical examiner program. We have followed up in the State Medical Examiner's Advisory Board meetings for the last 2 years. We have attended those meetings and listened to the discussions in those meetings. Under another context, we have become aware that the Health Division believes that there is no need to make any changes to these laws, 146 in particular, and I'm not sure if they're referencing ORS 97 at the same time. But the fact of the matter is that we simply, as citizens, do not agree with that point of view. We feel that there is a need, a demonstrated need, to attach these ameliorations and present them to the legislature and see if they can be enacted into law, and that these provisions will enhance the accountability of the medical examiner's program to those to whom it serves and provide relief from the ambiguity of certain present statutes. We feel that should some or all of these changes be enacted into law, the Oregon Medical Examiner statutes will no longer have the potential for conflict with the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act consent provisions in ORS 97250 through 290. The other issues addressed in these bills will, if they become law, eradicate internal inconsistency in laws that are very important to have as clear as possible. We also feel that they will contribute to the providing of statutory protection that we feel Oregonians desire and deserve. I thank you for your attention to these issues and the valuable time that I know you're devoting to the consideration of the problems. And I'll be glad to answer questions or to go to the summary.
Questions by committee members? Senator Hamby, would you recommend that she do what?
Yes, I do have, I'm sure we all have in our folders a little outline that, brief outline that Connie has prepared for Senator Kitzhaber. So questions might well stem from it as you peruse the subjects covered in it. But.
And then and the staff measure analysis that was given to us by council is also quite helpful. So we've had a chance already, of course, that being in the file, to go through it. Now, did you, either one of the other two, have more to add?
I believe that they do.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Be glad to hear from you then. Tell us your name. And
my name is Claire Green, and I'm a member of Concerned Citizens for Laws of Consent also, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. In the packet of written communications that you've received is a letter from me that outlines and basically presents the points that I feel are the most important in what we're presenting as a bill that we hope will become law. And I would like to just summarize briefly what those points of interest are for me. Again, I do feel that all of the points that are in these bills are important. These are simply the most important ones in my view. There is contained in Senate Bill 313 a religious exemption clause. And what that would do is provide individuals whose beliefs require it a clear exemption from autopsy of death when that death occurs under circumstances that are not threatening to society and under circumstances in which the medical examiner does not have a specific need in his judgment to determine the cause of death, whether
you mean like where the cause of death would be fairly obvious, like an automobile accident.
If he determines that there's no need, either because of the possibility of contagious disease or because of the possibility of criminal activity, for determining that, this exemption I do view as imperative to the protection of free exercise of religious belief, and I would hope that the state of Oregon would elect to be in the forefront of those who recognize that need for protection, and that Oregon would accordingly legislate that exemption.